Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Solis, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Jan de Winter, an independent scholar based in Ghent. His new book, Interests and Epistemic Integrity in Science, is just out from Roman and Littlefield. In the 1960s, Thomas Kuhn argued in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions that scientists' choices between competing theories could not be determined by the empirical evidence. Ever since, philosophers of science have debated the role of non-epistemic values and interests in science, generally agreeing that such influences are undesirable even if they are inevitable. In his new book, Jan de Winter argues that the direct influence of non-epistemic interests in science is not invariably epistemically problematic. In his view, what is mistaken for an epistemic problem is often a lack of transparency regarding the interests involved in how a scientific decision has been reached. De Winter also defends a conception of epistemic integrity in the conduct of scientific research that does not presuppose a distinction between interests that are external to science, such as financial interests, and those which are internal to it. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Jan de Winter. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hello.
Thank you for agreeing to talk with us about your new book, Interests and Epistemic Integrity in Science. Before we get to the book, can we hear a little bit about yourself? I mean, you are an independent scholar, yes. Which is, atypical in the sense that most people doing research are usually affiliated with in some university position. So can you say a bit about, your background as a philosopher and, how you're doing as far as an independent scholar goes and how you came to write this particular book?
So I currently work as an ethics teacher. So my pupils are between 12 and 18 years old, and I teach ethics. I also got a PhD in philosophy in the field of philosophy of science. So I worked a couple of years at Ghent University for the Center for Logic and Philosophy of Science. And the book is basically a result of that research that I did at the Center for Logic and Philosophy of Science. Now, after my grant ended, I still continue doing research, and even now I work in vacations. I still write a paper, and a couple of weeks ago I went to the World Conference on Research Integrity. So I still try to do I still try to stay connected to the philosophical world, actually. Now, teaching and doing research combine very well, because the things that I learn in my research can also be used in my teaching. So that's really a nice fit, actually. Now, I also want to say something about how I became interested in philosophy, if that's okay.
Sure, sure.
I kind of expected this question, and so I started thinking about this a couple of weeks ago, and this shed a whole new light on the book, actually. When I started going back in my history, I regarded my own book in a new light, and so I thought maybe it would be interesting to talk about this.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I became interested in philosophy when I was like 16 or 17 years old. Currently, I'm 31, so that's like a long time ago. So I was at that time, I was interested in animal ethics because I was working at this animal shelter, and I started thinking about the way animals are treated in the food industry and also in pharmaceutical experiments. Mm-hmm. And I became interested in that, and so I wanted to study moral sciences, which is a study where you have a lot of ethics but also a lot of philosophy. And really the thinking about animal ethics was also, or it was always connected to an interest in philosophy of science as well, because at the animal shelter there was a guy who treated animals in a very different way. So he had read a lot about dogs, and so he treated these dogs very differently from other people. He behaved very differently around these dogs. And so as a result, the dogs responded very differently, and it's like some dogs barked a lot at all people, but when he was around, they stopped barking and they followed him around. And so I saw that these animals were behaving very differently. And, well, I thought it's because he had a different understanding of these animals that he treated them differently. And so the question, how should we treat animals, was to me linked to how should we look at animals. And and that became, so that was my first interest, but then these questions became more general. The question, how should we treat others, which is an ethical question, was linked to how should we look at others, how should we look at the world. And at that time, I thought that science was the best way to look at the world. It was, in my view, kind of an objective way to look at the world. And so I became interested in the scientific way of looking at the world. And that's how I turned to philosophy of science, actually. Now that's relevant for my book because the last chapter is on animals. And so if you read the book, I think if you read the book, then you probably saw this last chapter as some additional chapter, which wasn't really the essence of the book. But as I look back at my own history, then maybe, you could actually also read the book as a 8 chapters of introduction to the 9th chapter, which is really important in my view.
Interesting. I do want to get to that, because you talked there about Franz de Waal and his research in animal ethics. Let's start at the beginning with the larger question. So you're talking about interests and epistemic integrity,
yes.
And the general goal of the book is to talk about the different types and roles of interests in science. I mean, it's a kind of a familiar general theme that, you know, science has interests, and interests affect science, but it's often not. People don't often go beyond that. And so what attracted me to the book was the idea that you were going to focus, what are these interests? What are the different types of interests? Which are the acceptable ones? Which are the unacceptable ones? How these relate to the issue of values and values in science? And look at in a more detailed way at the role of interests and to some extent values in science. So you start out, you kind of lay out a general conceptual groundwork for the rest of the discussion in terms of, you know, saying what are interests versus what are values or goals as a subset of interests, and then what are epistemic interests versus non-epistemic interests, and then various concepts of influence, right? How interests of various types can have various types of influence in science. So could you explain these basic distinctions that you draw and give some examples of each of them?
Yes. So first of all, I start by explaining what I mean by interests. And so I see interests as a relation between an agent and a state or a potential state or a potential circumstance, which is somewhere in the future. And now the relation is basically that the state or the circumstance is regarded by the agent as beneficial. So it thinks that it would be a good thing if the state would be realized in the future. So for instance, if you think of a health interest, then you have a certain health state. So for instance, you are sick, and a situation in which you no longer have a certain disease is a potential state in the future which you regard as beneficial. So that's an example of an health interest. If you another example is if you want to have $1 billion in the future, then this state in which you have $1 billion is an interest, because that's a state in the future which is regarded as beneficial. So that's an example of a financial interest. Now, a second concept, which I clarify, is a value, because, well, there has been written a lot about values by philosophers, but less about interests. So I had to clarify a bit the link between the literature on values, which I used, and on the other end, the topic that I wanted to write about, interests in science. And so I regarded a value as a property which is regarded as beneficial for an entity of a certain kind. So a certain property is viewed as a value for a certain kind of entity if we regard this property as beneficial for an entity of that kind. An example I give in the book is the property of speed for race cars. So this is a race car can be fast or slow. And this is regarded as a value because we want race cars to be fast. So here you also have a relation between an agent and a property in this case, because you still have an agent who values this, but speed is really a property and not, yeah, it's not characterized as a relation. Now, the two are closely connected, interests and values, because for instance, if you say speed is a value for a race car, then this can lead to the interest of having a fast race car, or the interest of tuning your car into a fast race car, and so on. So the two are closely connected, and that's why the relevant the literature on values is very relevant for my book. Now, I also make a distinction between different kinds of interests. So we have epistemic interests and non-epistemic interests. An epistemic interest is regarded as a desire to know something. So, for instance, you want to know why a certain event happened. That's an explanatory interest. So that's an epistemic interest because you want to know something. Another example is if you have a certain hypothesis and you want to have evidence which support this hypothesis, that's also a kind of an epistemic interest. Now, all other interests are non-epistemic. Now, maybe I should say something. There has been a lot of controversy about the distinction between epistemic and non-epistemic values. But, well, there has been a criticism on this distinction, but these criticisms do not apply to my distinction, because I don't assume that epistemic interests are separated from non-epistemic interests. They are often very closely connected. For instance, if a pharmaceutical company wants to have evidence that a drug is safe because it believes that such evidence will help the company sell the product, which serves its financial interests, and you have a case in which an epistemic interest in evidence is linked to financial interests. So the two can be closely related, and I don't say that they are always separated. So that's an important aspect of this distinction.
Okay. So let me just, you know, a lot of people who are familiar with philosophy of science, you know, for at least many people trained in the analytic tradition will associate the idea of values in science, you know, from the first, you know, first mention of that with Thomas Kuhn and the structure of scientific revolution sort of put that idea, you know, in the forefront of, you know, at least part of philosophy of science. And there the idea, you know, was that, I mean, you know, a number of people that you mentioned, you know, Helen Longino and Heather Douglas and other people, you know, have continued some of that. But the basic idea was that in some sense, science, there are values. I mean, I know I'm getting into values here rather than interests, and you just drew that distinction. But the whole idea that, you know, something is problematic when non-epistemic, you know, values or interests or both gets involved in science. And Kuhn was famously, like, roundly criticized for saying that theory choice, and that's one of the cases that you give, that theory choice is not just determined by the empirical facts. And, you know, people – and instead it was – you know, the caricature was that, you know, he was arguing that it was a matter of, you know, mob psychology, as they put it, which he didn't like. You know, he argued against that, but still. Could you sort of give us an overview of, you know, why, you know, what the problem is with values or with interests and non-epistemic interests, I guess, in particular, in science?
So there are some cases known in which financial interest, for instance, but also you also have examples of political interest playing in science, and then you clearly have a sense that there is something wrong with these interests influencing science. For instance, I already said, suppose a pharmaceutical company wants to accept that a drug is safe and it collects evidence, but then it manipulates the evidence because it sees that actually a drug is not safe, and they want to end up with a safe drug, because if they can make people believe that the drug is safe, then they can sell this drug. Now, if they start manipulating data because this serves their interest, then you see there is a problem. You have the sense that there is something wrong, and usually or traditionally, people say, yeah, that's because financial interests have no place in science. And that explains why there is a problem. Now, for instance, Thomas Kuhn, his research showed that this view was a bit too simplistic. And that's basically the idea that I wanted to build on. Now, today, philosophers of science accept certain parts of the work of Thomas Kuhn, and a lot of other philosophers think that values play an important role in science, but they still think that accepting a hypothesis on the basis of interest, that is still problematic. And so they say in that phase of research, interest should not play a role. And that's something which I was questioning.
Right. No, that was one of the important points I thought you made in the book, was that we shouldn't, It's not a sort of a blanket problem. It there are certain ways in which that influence is not negative. You draw a distinction between the sort of ideal, the what do you call the full ideal of purity of science. And as you just indicated, you know, more recent philosophers of science have, you know, kind of stepped away from that, you know, basic ideal of science. But then there's still what you call the partial ideal of purity. And a lot of people think that, you know, that's still, an ideal that we should hold. So could you explain the difference between the full ideal of purity, and then the partial idea of purity, and, you know, why you think, I mean, this is sort of a crucial, argument that you make in the book, why the partial ideal of purity should be abandoned just like the full ideal of purity.
So first I'll explain the partial ideal of purity. So, basically, the idea is that in decisions such as hypothesis acceptance or theory choice, interest should not have a direct influence. So, Kuhn showed that they kind of had an influence through values, because scientists accept certain values, and these values can play in deciding which theory to choose. Now, Kuhn also said that which values you choose can be influenced by the personal preferences of the scientist. And so you can say here the personal interests of the scientist can affect which values he chooses. And so that's a kind of an indirect influence on theory choice. Now, if you say, okay, there are a lot of ways in which values play, even in theory choice, but this influence is also always indirect, then this is the partial ideal of purity, which says that's a direct influence of interests on decisions such as hypothesis acceptance is never acceptable. And what do I mean by a direct influence is that an interest is used as a standalone reason to accept this hypothesis. Or if you take theory choice, if an interest is used as a standalone reason to choose one theory over others, then this is a direct influence. If a pharmaceutical company says this drug is safe, why? Because this serves our interest, that is a problem, according to the partial ideal of purity. Now, I was thinking about this, and I thought that there were cases in which you have an hypothesis. I focused on explanatory hypothesis, and in which you say, I accept this explanatory hypothesis because it serves my interest, and this is not necessarily a problem. So that's basically the point I want to make in the book.
Okay, well, one of the big issues, there's drug testing and or research and things like that, but also the whole idea of climate change. I mean, particularly in the United States, the denial of climate or denial of the human causes of global warming. Here you're not talking about the interests of scientists, influencing how they do science, what theories they accept, what explanations they accept, and so forth. But it's a nearby problem in the sense of certain people, outside of science, their interests affecting, what happens with scientific hypotheses. How do you see that sort of relationship between, I guess, the public, maybe I should put it, public interests and how science is accepted or rejected, outside of science itself?
Yes, but I think so. You make a distinction between science on the one hand, and there you have scientists, and on the other hand, the outside of science, where there are politicians and so on, and the public.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that distinction can really be made, because scientists also are just people, and they also have interests and political ideas, political goals. And so I think even in science, these interests play an important role.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, for example, with global warming, how might those interests be played out in terms of the science itself?
Yes. So, if you see at the work of the IPCC, so I regard this as a scientific organization.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of scientists are involved, but you also see that governments of different countries are involved in the process because they review the reports of the IPCC. And so, all of these countries, the interests of all of these countries are part of the making of the IPCC reports, so they are really in the scientific process, these interests play a role. So I don't really.
Yeah. You don't draw the distinction that I just did.
No.
Okay.
I think that, scientists and outsiders,
mm-hmm.
Non-scientists are all involved in this process because, the non-scientists may not do the research, but they still influence these researchers, and these researchers are connected to these people, also have similar interests. And I think that these interests play in the scientific process. When scientists have a hypothesis, they think about how should I formulate this hypothesis, and in deciding whether to accept certain formulations of a hypothesis or of certain conclusions. And in thinking about this question, they take all of these interests into account, their own interests, also interests of others. And I think this is actually a good thing that they do this.
Okay. So let me go back to the partial purity, because you spend a bit of time on that, the partial ideal of purity, I should say. And you go through various your argument sort of turns on a particular issue of explanation, right? Certain explanations being acceptable or not acceptable for certain, you know, because of certain interests that may be non-epistemic non-epistemic or epistemic. Could you sort of go through that a bit about, you know, the more of your argument against the partial ideal of purity?
So, well, I started thinking that the partial ideal of purity was problematic when I was writing a paper on mechanistic artifacts explanation, in which one explains an artifact's behavior by describing the underlying mechanism. And well, I was writing a philosophical paper on this topic, and so I developed a very simple artifact, and I described the mechanism underlying the behavior of the artifact. And then I published this paper, and then after a while, I discovered that my explanation was not entirely correct. So if you would actually make the artifact that I described, it would not exactly work as I described it, because there were some details which were not correct. Now, I was thinking, should I adjust this explanation so that it becomes fully accurate? And then I thought about my own interests, the ideas that I want to make clear. And I thought if I would drop all of these inaccuracies, then my explanation would become very complex. The reader would have to make a lot of effort in understanding this explanation. And so I thought maybe I should just leave these inaccuracies in my explanation, because, well, the explanation in its current form serves my philosophical interests, and so there's no problem. Mm-hmm. Now, I was thinking scientists, maybe they are often in similar situations, because they too make a lot of idealizations on the basis of their interests. So sometimes they simplify certain things because simple explanations are easier to work with. And that was basically my motivation for criticizing the partial ideal of purity, because that states that you should not accept an explanation on the basis of your interests, while I saw even your interests can overrule accuracy. So if you think of science as something as a process in which you only use the criterion of empirical accuracy, then this is a problem. If you see in scientific practice that scientists don't just look at accuracy, but they too use idealizations and look at their interests in order to accept certain inaccuracies. And so that's basically my criticism of the partial ideal of purity.
Okay, so let me just, so if you know, someone might respond to that what you said is true. You know, we might accept an inaccurate or highly idealized or sketchy explanation. You know, even scientists would do this for certain reasons, certain contexts, and what have you. And it seems like, you know, somebody might respond to you saying that can be true, but, you know, when the scientists are sort of really doing science, as opposed to, say, pedagogy or, you know, some other interest, right? That's when there may be differences certainly in levels of abstraction, you know, in terms of you know, what sort of a mechanistic explanation is acceptable. So there can be different acceptable explanations within science, even say within the mechanistic explanatory framework, but for the purposes of, of science, all of those are going to be, sort of driven by epistemic interest. We want to get it right. Maybe we don't need all the details here. Maybe just these ones matter in this context and so forth. But as far as the science goes, our interests are still, epistemic. And I would never go for another explanation driven by something non-epistemic. I mean, how would you respond to that person?
Yeah, so I would say accuracy is an important value in science. But also, even the value of accuracy can be linked to interest, because you want certain hypotheses which are accurate, because this accuracy is important for your interests to be served. Now, but you also, so it's not just accuracy that you want, but you also take these interests into account. So you have many things that you have to take into account in deciding whether or not to accept a hypothesis. You should look at the evidence, but you should also constantly think about what is it I'm willing to do with this hypothesis, what will it be used for, and so you always have to take your interests into account. Also, if you decide whether or not to accept a hypothesis, you can think, if I use this formulation and I accept it and I publish this, what will the consequences be? Will there be certain social interests which will be damaged? And these kind of things have to play in your decision whether or not to accept a hypothesis. And it's not just the evidence. So you want your explanation to be accurate because, that's important for your interests to be served. But other inaccuracies can be accepted if these inaccuracies do not damage your interests. So to me, there's really no problem of these non-epistemic interests playing in itself.
So if you had a biologist, one of the cases you talk about is in biology. If you have somebody who is a fundamentalist Christian or something, very devout, who is also a biologist, and reject evolution, or they only accept it in certain very constrained circumstances, and the reason that they do that is because, they have this belief system which says, evolution in some sense contradicts that. So on your view, would the scientist, the biologist, say, who rejects evolution for, because it could, because as he or she sees it, it conflicts with their religious convictions, or, with their place in a religious, community, would that scientist somehow be doing something, wrong, or is that just a case where, it's perfectly acceptable to do that?
So to me, this is a difficult question, because I think I could have certain ethical problems with what he's doing on the basis of my own beliefs. And, I can use certain ethical theories to decide whether or not what he's doing is wrong, if I believe that what he's doing will have certain negative effects on certain people. Then this can be an argument to believe that what he's doing is morally wrong. But if I just look at the epistemic, at epistemic integrity, which is an ideal that I use in my book, to see whether there is an epistemic problem, then I'd say that if the biologist is very clear and open about what he is doing, then there's not necessarily an epistemic problem in this. But there could be a moral problem. So that's an important distinction. I mean, if I say that something is not epistemically problematic, I don't mean that he's not doing anything wrong, but epistemically there is no problem, I think so.
Huh. So, well,
if certain conditions are met, I mean,
right.
The person has to be very clear about what he's doing, and it should be clear to the audience what he's doing, and there should not be some ambiguities about that. So,
well, let's get to this idea of epistemic integrity, which, you know, that's where you focus the second part of the book, because I want to get more of that on the table before we sort of discuss the biologist, the religious biologist further.
Yes.
So you draw distinctions again between moral versus epistemological concepts, and then, you know, agents, you know, scientists, so forth, and then their behavior, you know, the research processes themselves. So this is the framework that you develop in order to go on to defend your own definition of the epistemic integrity of a research process. So could you lay the framework a bit of, you know, how you talk about epistemic integrity?
Yes. So epistemic integrity is so I say you have different kinds of scientific integrity. On the one hand, you have epistemological concepts of scientific integrity. On the other hand, you have ethical concepts of scientific integrity. Now, the epistemological concepts, they relate to the good in light of epistemic considerations. So that means that what is good in light of the goal of science to produce reliable knowledge? And so epistemological concepts focus on that kind of integrity. Now, you could also have other considerations, for instance, social considerations, economic considerations. All of these considerations are taken into account when you assess a scientific process. And when you assess all of those aspects of the research process, then you are talking about moral integrity. So ethical concepts focus on the good in general, the good in light of social, economic, epistemological considerations, while epistemological concepts focus on the good in light of the epistemic goals of science, the goal to produce reliable knowledge. And yeah, I also make a distinction between integrity of agents on the one hand and integrity of behavior on the other hand. Now, the two can be linked to each other. So, for instance, if you you could say that an agent should be assessed on the basis of his behavior, and then integrity of an agent is linked to integrity of the research process. But in the book, I only focus on integrity of the research process, and I only focus on epistemic integrity of the research process. So I want to talk about what is good in light of the goal to produce reliable knowledge for a research process.
So let me just, you know, kind of illustrate that or follow that up with the, you know, again, with the religious biologist. So on your view, and correct me if I'm wrong, on your view, if he chooses, say, you know, to reject the theory of evolution because of his, say, interests in maintaining his religious convictions, right? Let's just, yeah. There's on your view, I take it there's nothing sort of problematic about that, right? Is that correct? Or
yeah, it depends on how he presents this, because this biologist, he probably wants to make a lot of people believe that what he's saying is true, and so he may want to deceive his audience in order to make them believe what he's saying, and then there is a problem. But if he's just clear, I just believe this hypothesis because it serves my personal interests, then that is not an epistemic problem in my view.
Uh-huh.
Now, maybe I should also say why I would say that is not an epistemic problem, because yeah, a lot of people would think this is strange.
Yes.
The reason is that there are there are a lot of differences of opinion on what standards are needed to produce reliable knowledge. And I wanted to have an account of epistemic integrity which can be accepted by everyone, regardless of your beliefs on what kind of research would deliver reliable knowledge. And so I wanted to have a definition. If I can show that epistemic integrity is damaged, then this conclusion is acceptable to people holding different beliefs on what kind of standards are needed to arrive at knowledge that you can trust. So that's basically the reason why I have a very liberal definition of epistemic integrity. But again, it's not because I'd say that epistemic integrity is not damaged in certain cases, that I say that this is morally no problem. I mean, morally, it can still be a problem, but epistemically, it is not. If the scientist is clear about what he's doing, why he accepts a certain hypothesis, and so on. So
as long as the biologist, you know, says I'm a biologist, I see this evidence, but I reject the evolutionary hypothesis because it conflicts with my religious views, that would not be an epistemic failure on his part?
No. Now, there's also a question, is this really science what he's doing? I mean, you could still argue that what he's doing is not science, and I could also say that I do not consider this reliable knowledge, but he's still producing a kind of information which I don't view as reliable knowledge, but he does think that it is reliable knowledge. And this means that there is no epistemic problem in my view.
Huh. Okay, so to go to the epistemic integrity of a research process, which is what we were mentioning before, to go back to that. So if this biologist is doing his research...
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it research, probably, but...
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I mean, why not? Actually, let me just press you on that. Why would I mean? If he's in a lab and he's doing various, or you know, however he would want to be testing these things. I mean, you know, I guess the issue that starts to get raised is, you know, when people start, you know, not. I don't mean just to get into sort of misconduct of their research, right? You know, cases of fraud and things like that. But if he's doing research that allows him to sort of come up with conclusions that seem to support what he, you know, his religious beliefs, or at least not conflict with them. But he's not doing anything wrong with the science. Is that you know? Then he's you know that would fall within your view as a perfectly, you know, epistemically valid way. You know, epistemically in that would he would be working within the confines of acting with epistemic integrity or not. I mean, what's
yeah. So. I think that is correct. I mean, if he does that, mm-hmm. Then he could do that with epistemic integrity, but it's very tricky because if he wants to find evidence which supports his ideas, uh-huh. then, this will only work if he is, if he doesn't admit his true motivation, because if people know his true motivation, they can think, oh yeah, but he just did that and that, so it's not really reliable, or I don't trust this guy. And so often these scientists keep certain things secret in order to get other people to believe them, and that's when the problem arises, in my view. Mm-hmm. So, but if he's open and clear, then there is no epistemic problem, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the strategy only works if you aren't open and clear about what you're doing.
Okay. So. Yeah, so there's a sort of a public criteria or publicity criterion about in being epistemic, in satisfying epistemic integrity.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so you go through, I mean, to continue with epistemic integrity, you go through a number of different definitions of that. We don't need to go through all of them, but you you end up with your own, which maybe that's where we should maybe you can tell us, you know, what one of the main ones that you find flawed, and then your own definition and how it avoids the flaws.
Okay, so well, I read a lot of definitions on integrity. Now, one of the most common is the idea that integrity is linked to honesty. So you have different ways of putting that, but often honesty is an important value which is linked to a definition of integrity. Now, the problem that I have with honesty, with focusing on honesty, is that honesty requires that there is no intention to deceive, and if you don't intend to deceive, even though you may deceive but unintentionally, then there's no dishonesty. And that was a bit of a problem to me, because, well, sometimes scientists are sloppy, and sometimes they are sloppy whenever being sloppy is useful for their interests. Uh-huh. And I wanted to have an account of integrity which can also explain why this kind of sloppiness is epistemically problematic. Should I give an example of
this? Yeah, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, so something that some pharmaceutical companies do is they have developed a certain drug, and they want to show that this is more effective than alternative drugs, and so they compare their own drug to inadequate doses of another drug, and so their drug comes out as more effective. Now, if they do that intentionally, then they are being dishonest. But it's also possible that they just didn't carefully consider what doses of the other drug would be most effective. Mm-hmm. And they may not look into the literature on that, but just take one study. And then they don't believe that they are wrong about the doses of the other drug, because maybe they found one publication, but they didn't decently investigate that. So they are not intentionally being dishonest, but they are being sloppy in a way that is beneficial for them. Mm-hmm. And well, in that case, there is no dishonesty. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to say there is an integrity problem, and therefore definitions which only focus on honesty are not very helpful in my view. So then I turn to other definitions, focus on existing standards. So they say you have certain professional organizations, and they determine certain standards that research should respect. And then integrity is adhering to these established standards. Now, a problem that I had with this view was, so I had a thought experiment. Suppose that you have a corrupt organization, and it's sets, so again, to use the example of pharmaceutical science, you have a certain pharmaceutical organization, and they say in order to show that a drug is unsafe, you need to have a lot of evidence, and they put the standard so high that actually it's almost impossible to show that a drug is unsafe. If there is then a scientist who gets some evidence that a drug can kill a lot of people, then he may see, okay, I believe that this drug is unsafe. But this evidence doesn't really, the evidence isn't sufficient according to the standards of the corrupt pharmaceutical organization. Now, in that case, if you use established standards as the basis of your definition of integrity, you would say that the scientist is wrong, and that the standards of the pharmaceutical organization are correct. And that is something I wanted to avoid, because I think it's important that scientists can also question established standards, and so I wanted a definition in which this is possible. For scientists to deviate from existing standards whenever this is best given the interests at play.
Okay. What I was going to raise before when you talked about sloppiness. You don't really talk about like the replication, you know, reproducibility crisis in psychology or anything like that. Are you familiar with those problems in psychology?
Yeah, I'm not very familiar with these problems, but I know about them. So you can ask a question about.
So I was just wondering. One of the problems. I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which, you know, some psychologists, or at least enough of them, they don't change their data in any way, you know, so there's none of the big sort of forms of misconduct going on. But, you know, there'll be some sort of, actually there's, you know, more or less widely accepted sorts of ways of conducting studies where, you know, you might stop collecting, you know, data or stop running subjects when you have a result that turns out to be statistically significant, you know, so you just stop, even if you were planning, or alternatively, you keep testing until you find some level at which there is some result that is statistically significant. So there's a lot of, you know, sort of little things that people will do to get a result that is publishable.
Yes,
and
yeah.
none of these things, you know, sometimes people say, you know, it's just kind of, it's a little bit sloppy. It's not that people are intentionally deceiving, like with a case of outright fraud. You know, it's clearly that there is interest there in getting published. So there are, you know, it's professional interests, right? Career interests, but everybody's got the career interests going. Is what they're doing, would that satisfy, or would that be ruled out by your definition of, you know, epistemic integrity of the research process?
Well, in theory, it doesn't. It is not necessarily epistemically problematic, but I think in practice it often is, because if a psychologist wants to have impressive results, then he probably shouldn't admit that he used these dubious techniques. I mean, I'm not really familiar with the problem, but I guess that scientists don't put in their article, "We just run tests until we get a significant result," but they just...
That's true, right.
Yeah, they don't say it. And then there is an epistemic problem, and I would say that that is a violation of epistemic integrity in that case.
I see. So, for example, if they said, you know, we sort of did this selective sampling, we stopped running subjects when we got statistically significant result, or we started with this statistical test and didn't get a significance, so we switched to this other one and we got significance. As long as it's revealed, it's not epistemically problematic. Is that the general idea?
And the reason why I accept that idea is because I want the audience to decide whether or not they regard a certain piece of information as reliable knowledge, and whether they trust this knowledge or this researcher.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that's basically one of the benefits of my definition, I think.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're starting to get run out of a bit of time. So I do want to, we started mentioning Franz de Waal and his animal research, and because of your initial interest in animal ethics. Could you say a bit about, you know, the case there of the unacceptable influences of his ideological interests in terms of his own research? And I don't know if you went into ideological interests all that deeply there, so, you know, feel free to elaborate on that a bit more. But could you say a bit about this final case, because it is, you know, it is sort of the capstone of the book at the very end.
Well, I think the problem that I saw with Franz de Waal's work is not unique to his work. I think this is something that happens in ethology in general. So the reason why I focused on Franz de Waal is because he is very clear about his ideology, or more clear than most other biologists. And so that was very interesting for me to look at his ideology and how it influenced his work. Now, what is his ideology? So to summarize his ideology, he puts humans on top. So he says humans have the highest moral status. Then there are apes, who are closer to us than other animals, and so they have the second moral status, and then you have all other animals, which have a lower moral status. And on the basis of this theory, this ideological theory. It makes a couple of claims about how animals should be treated in experiments and how humans should be treated in experiments and so on. Now, I thought that his that this ideology influenced his work by, well, this ideology, he would probably want other peoples to accept this ideology as well, in order so that other peoples will behave in accordance with this ideology, so that he has less problems with how other people are acting. And so I thought he would probably want other people to accept this ideology, and they would do that if they believe that humans are more complex, have a more complex emotional life than apes, and that apes have more complex emotional life than other animals. In order to make people believe that humans have a more complex emotional life, he makes certain claims, and he acts as if these claims are supported by decent research. And if you look closer into this work, then you see that sometimes that is not the case. So he makes certain claims. He acts as if these are supported by evidence, but actually they are not that good supported. And so that's basically an epistemic problem, because his ideology affects his research in an epistemically unacceptable way.
So if he... if he was, well, you said he's forthright about his ideology in terms of moral standing, right? He's clear about, you know, we have the top full standing, and then apes, and then everything else. And I guess the epistemic. So from your perspective, the there's no epistemic problem with him being clear, because he's being public. Right.
Yes.
About his interests. Right. The problem is more, it seems to be just a more straightforward one of the theories that he supports, don't have the empirical evidence that he claims they do.
Yeah, I have different examples. So, for instance, he says that, or he insinuates that ants don't have the building blocks of morality. And that's a claim that is not. So he refers to his own research. But if you look at the article that he uses to support his claim, or that he puts at the end of this phrase, then you see that this research does not concern ants at all, and it doesn't refer to any other study of ants. And so you see that he makes a conclusion. And by putting a source after this claim, he gives the reader the impression that he has thought about this in a scientifically sound way. But you see that this is just a claim that he makes without any consideration if you look closer into the research.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another example, and maybe a more convincing one, is that he presents himself as someone who thinks that anthropomorphism is important in biology. And so this is the idea that human qualities are also present in animals, and that animal behavior should be interpreted in ways which are consistent with how we interpret human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he says that we should, he doesn't say we should just accept that, but he says we should take this possibility serious. So, if animals and humans act in the same way, then we should at least consider that animals have the same underlying mental processes. So that's the way he presents himself. But then if you look closer at his research, then you see that sometimes he doesn't take such hypotheses seriously, but he just neglects them. And so he violates a standard that he himself says is respected.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, this is an epistemic problem.
Okay, I see. Gee, let's see. There was one general question that very quickly. Do you think that, you know, epistemic, you know, unacceptable, you know, influences of non-epistemic interests have gotten worse in recent decades? I mean, you start the book. I didn't mention this before, but you start. You know, I think you mentioned something about, you know, changes in funding structures, and it's certainly true. I mean, there's much more in pharmaceuticals, for example, very clearly there's much more privately funded research compared to government or publicly funded research. Do you think that the problem of or problematic or unacceptable instances or cases of interests influencing science or failures of epistemic integrity, do you think these are getting worse? And if so, is there any relation between that and the changes in the funding structure of science?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question, I think, because there are so many things to consider. But I think the fact that that financial interests become more and more important could be an indication that the problems are getting worse. But I think that the problems in the past were also some important problems in the past, which are less today. For instance, if you think of intelligence studies in which black people are compared to white people, I think that there used to be some racist interests which influenced such research, and maybe that's less today. So I think there are also some positive evolutions, and it's very difficult to say whether it's today worse than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are different. Today, financial interests are more there in science, so that's a danger, although it can also have a positive influence. So yeah, it's a very difficult question, but perhaps I shouldn't answer it then.
Well, maybe you can answer this one. I mean, what are you working on now? What's on your research plate at this point?
So currently I'm looking into this Frans de Waal case closer, because in the book I say that he says that he insinuates or give the reader the impression that certain standards are respected, and then he doesn't respect those standards. That's a problem. But currently I want to argue that what he is doing is problematic from an ethical point of view, regardless of the standards that he claims to respect. So I want to look closer into this case, and in the future I want to look at biology in general. Do similar problems occur in other research processes and so on, and then use these questions to think about the question of how should we treat animals.
Good. Okay. Well, we are out of time. That's been a pretty quick hour. I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy about your book, and I wish you the best of luck with the research that you're doing right now.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to my interview with Yonda Winter, independent scholar who teaches ethics to children and adolescents. We've been talking about his new book, Interests and Epistemic Integrity in Science, A New Framework to Assess Interest Influences in Scientific Research Processes. This book is just out from Lexington Books. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.